And we are back. Black and a Half, episode number 250.
250.
Yeah. I'm Silas Lindenstein.
I'm Samantha Rund.
And this is Black and a Half, the longest running pod.
The
longest running comedy podcast in Seattle. Probably. This is a great episode. We have a special guest on this time. Mr. Paul Boyd, director and writer of the new film Scared to Death. It's a horror comedy distributed by Atlas Distribution Company, and it comes out on March 13th. It's a fun film. I got to check it out, and some fun actors in it. We get to talk to the director about what made him come up with the idea and chat with him. I mean, it's actually, I had to meet with him a separate time, and then Samantha watched the interview and shared her thoughts, and I shared my thoughts, and it jarred some conversation. Yeah.
I think it's a good episode, you guys. I recommend that you stay tuned.
We made some winning moves. Let me just say this. If you listen to this, I checkmate. Okay? Checkmate.
We're got game.
Game, set, match.
Game, set, match.
I think that would be fun to start using at times other than tennis. Just, you finish, you win something, you win in a poker game, you go, game, set, match. Just do it. Really confusing to people. Anyway.
Yeah. That'd be kind of like a fun brand for like matches. Like actual matches. Right?
I imagine the match market is dwindled a bit.
I imagine as well, because you could also like cigarettes, not good for you. But if you had a brand of cigarettes called Game, you had the ashtray set and the matches match.
Well, good thing that you're marketing now to the cigarette companies. That's good.
Give them some
ideas.
Yeah.
I just don't know when I use a match very much. Like I need a lighter sometimes for my stove.
Uh-huh.
Because the thing's not sparking. But that's the only time I use a lighter.
Well, I guess for candles, but I usually use the lighter and instead of matches as well.
And they're not, but candles are just, now we kind of know that they're not good for you. So
lots of things aren't good for you. Live a little. I mean, with certain things, right? I don't have candles on all of the time or as many hours as I used to, but I still do have candles, and like you want it to be in a ventilated area.
Yeah. I forget. There's something about, I don't know if it causes asthma or something. There's something that they just don't.
Yeah.
We're not supposed to have them in my house anymore. We're not supposed to do them very much.
Well, yeah.
We do them, but not very. Oh, because there's so many allergies.
Yeah.
That she could. My kid or my wife is going to be allergic to one of the
toxins or whatever, right? I mean, it's not good to have like burning stuff and smelling the fumes of it. It smells so delicious.
Funny. Used to burn incense. I don't know. Never even thought of that being bad for you, but apparently it is. Anyway, we got to get to this interview.
You know what's not bad for you, though? This podcast.
Yeah, that's right. Fat free.
Game, set, match.
This is a fat for, there's gluten free, everything. Listening with your ears or watching with your eyes, there is no health dangers in this. RKO approved. Look, RKO? No, that's Randy Orton's finishing move. I said the wrong one. To say RFK approved.
No,
but RK,
why? But no, because
sugar-free. RKO is a, that's a move.
Our show is actually good for you. We want to have an approval.
That's true.
All
right. Folks, sit back, relax, open your hearts, open your ear holes, and listen to episode number 250 of Black and a Half, our interview with Paul Boyd.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to the longest running comedy podcast in Seattle, probably. Yes, this is Black and a Half, hosted by Silas Lindenstein and Samantha Rund.
It's called Black and a Half, and
longest running comedy podcast in Seattle. So I'm always excited to get talented comedic writers, filmmakers, and such. A question for you. Now, a lot of times directors and writers will be one of the characters in there. Are you Grok? Was that?
I wish I was the Grok, man. Honestly, I wish I was the Grok. I'm more Jasper, I would say, as a filmmaker. But, you know, the interesting thing about the Grok, you know, he's also the executive producer and the financer of the movie.
Oh, really? Okay.
Kurt Dimer, who plays the Grok, is the Grok. Like, when I cast him in the movie, I was like, wear your own clothes. But that's him being him. Like, that's not, you know, I mean, that is really what he's like. And he's such a big teddy bear, but looks so tough, but he's just this big sweetheart that I kind of wrote the character around that. And I also made him the butt of the joke, but also kind of the hero, and gave him the tagline of "This reminds me of a movie," which allowed me to set up his history at the end of the film with all the posters. And, you know, because he represents the joy of filmmaking. Like, you know, he's made 200 movies, but he still loves it. He doesn't love his passion for the business. Yeah, so it was really dealing with all the different aspects of the film team that I know so well. You know, they say write about what you know.
Yeah,
I mean, the comedy comes from just the irony in the situation rather than jokes. It's just these people set up against one another.
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, I mean, what was the impetus for the film? Was it the desire to make a horror or a comedy or like what?
It was a horror. You know, I bought a house and was told the day before I moved in, but from the owner, that it was haunted. And this was originally owned by Chaplin, 1911. It was for sale by him, not through a realtor. We moved in. I never saw anything, but my wife and kids did. They've seen it. And I never, and I got up in the middle of the night, take a pee, look in the mirror, be like, I scared myself shitless thinking. Yeah. Something. But I never did. And, you know, this whole theory of believing is seeing rather than seeing is believing came out of that experience. And knowing, wanting to make, you know, living in oblivion, you know what I mean? I wanted to make a kind of film about filmmakers that's kind of a little absurd and ridiculous. And I thought putting those two things together would be great. You know, filmmakers trying to make a movie set in a, you know, in a haunted house. But I mean, every trope is in the book.
Yeah.
Haunted house, the seance, you know what I mean? It's all in there. Because it's a kind of love letter. It's a love letter to horror movies, but wrapped within this kind of satirical, absurdist jacket.
So are you a believer then in the ghosts?
I've never seen a ghost. You know, I grew up in Scotland where ghosts and witches and warlocks are present. I mean, that's, you know, our national animal is a unicorn. I mean,
yeah.
Think about that.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up and we were doing Ouija boards when we were little kids. I mean, we would cut out all the numbers and put them on the sidewalk. And I was talking about what made us even do that as kids. So I think the supernatural is ingrained into the belief system. But I know I'm kind of agnostic. But in the same aspect of UFOs, I've never seen one. Do I believe? Absolutely. Interdimensionality, I believe in that. Like, look at dogs. They can see what we can't see.
Yeah,
our eyes filter out most of what we can't see, and that right there is interesting because it's like, what is really outside that we just, you know, and playing into the science of the brain is what really sees, which is true, not the eyes, and that gets mentioned in the film. The whole science behind that, you know, I'm also making another film about sleep paralysis and what that represents. So I'm into the science of it and tried to put a little bit of that into Scared to Death.
So you're doing another film. Like, how many films are you working on at a time?
There's one in post, one in pre, and usually one shooting. So we're right now we're releasing Scared to Death. We're finishing Relapse, which is a film I shot last May. Kurt's in that film too, which is about a young girl, a musician that uploads her nervous breakdown onto social media, and there's a whole intervention. And it's really intense. There's music in it. We do a cover of In the Air Tonight. Phil, I mean, it's kind of like a Billie Eilish type young girl.
Okay.
And there's so we did that, and that is, we're finishing sound, and that's going into festival. And then we're shooting another film at the beginning of summer called The Prostitute, which Kurt is starring in, which is about a serial killer that dresses up in a silicone mask and goes out and kills Johns. And it's done in the style of Man Bites Dog. It's like a fake documentary. I've always wanted to do an American or European, British take on Man Bites Dog. You remember that movie from the early 90s?
Like, it's very familiar. Like, it's on the tip of my
1990 in Belgium. It came out kind of the same time as all those movies. But anyway, it's brilliant. It's black and white, 16mm film. This group of filmmakers following a serial killer around. And he's talking to camera about the process and what he does. Ours is a little different. It's about a filmmaker that discovers the serial killer and is covertly filming, and then they kind of team up. But it's all done in the style of a documentary, one camera from one person's point of view. So we're doing that this summer, and that's So I mean, you know, these are little independent movies. That to me, I just want to make a film a year. You know, until we get to a place where I can take some of my bigger projects and spend more time. But you know.
Oh, so are you and Kurt partnered now? Like, as
we're definitely creative partners, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I've written like 4 scripts for him in the last few years. We're doing an animated TV show called BBG. Which is a kind of satirical adult horror cartoon. And we have a television show. I mean, we get so much shit going on, you know, but everything has to kind of fall in line.
How do you find a partner like that? Was this just a random meeting? Was it from a casting?
It was actually through a rock and roll manager called Andy Gould, who I've known for years. And Andy was his manager, taking care of his music. But Andy also produced movies for Rob Zombie. So when he first started working with Kurt, he brought me in to make some videos for him. I did like a triptych 3 music video thing. And I did it on the basis of, look, if he wants to help and be part of the film, you know, then... You know, it was a trade-off. So I got to meet him and talk about it. And he just instantly wanted to do it, you know, because I rewrote the character for the Grog. And then, you know, within talking about it and doing it, it was a year, of us just putting it together, developing it. And because I already had Lynn and Bill, you know, they were already attached regardless of the money. So, but, you know, you can't make a film without any money, even if you have talent.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, you can. It's time, money, idea, and you only need 2. So if you don't have any money, you need a shitload of time.
Yeah.
And idea. And this film literally was 10 years. I made 3 other movies. Yeah. It took 10 years minimum from when we first tried to make it to actually making it.
How long of that was just writing it to getting it to the point of we're going to shoot this?
Well, the script was written, but it got rewritten over those 10 years, right? So, and then when it became a comedy, you know, with Lynn, when the roles of Lynn and Bill shifted and I knew I needed Lynn in a comedy, then it went through more rewrites. There's probably like 50 drafts. No joke.
Wow.
You know, but when it evolved into comedy, that all changed. And you know, the way I work, there's 3 scripts. There's the one you write, the one you shoot, and the one you end up with. And that's my process. You know, I want to improvise with actors. I want them to bring more to the table than just my words on a page. Mm-hmm. I always say to them, look, as long as you say what I'm trying to say, say it in your own way. Say it in the way the character says it. Not, you know, a Nazi over dialogue. Oh, you got to be like this. I'm very freeform. And, you know, I like people to bring their ideas to the table, especially the actors. It's important.
As an actor, I always love it when a director is, you sound like an actor's director. And I always like that.
Yeah, I know I could never act. You know what I mean? That's the thing. If you respect the medium, right? And I've been a filmmaker since I was 13. So, you know, in all aspects of actors, from wannabe actors, models, people that have never acted, fully experienced act. I've worked with a gamut, and I believe anyone can do it. Like with Kurt in this movie, he'd only been in a couple of small things before his own movie, but it was just empowering him to know that he can do it by just being himself, and modeling him to take him out of a place of fear, but in a place of a fuck it. And I worked with Dave Stewart from the Eurythmics for years, and he was like this. He was like, I bring an artist in the studio, they go, oh, wait, oh, that doesn't sound right. I'm not sure if I want to do that. He goes, doesn't matter. We won't fucking release it. We won't put it out. He said, just doing it is the process, you know. And I kind of believe that too. So in this film, when it all kind of changed shape, I had to let go and kind of be like, okay, just trust the process, trust my own instincts with regards to comedy, because I'm not a comedy writer. I mean, my second film is a stoner comedy, but it's the same thing. It's more situational. It's not jokes. That's what I want to evolve to. Like, we have this Western we want to do where we want to cast all comedians and do like the proper, you know, a couple of big comedians. So hopefully we'll get to that place where you get to work with the talent that can just write the jokes.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
In oh, yeah.
That's a dream of mine. You know, I love watching that process and the behind the scenes of the making of comedies where they're doing scenes over and over and they're just changing the word. Mm-hmm. God, I'd love to be in a situation like that with some proper comedians.
I look forward to seeing what you do with the Western. I'll tell you that. Now, Paul, the first time I have somebody on a show, I have seven questions that I ask everybody. They're the Black and a Half world famous seven questions. So I'm going to shoot these out to you. Okay.
Yeah.
Number one, what are you most nerdy about? And that doesn't mean sci-fi. It's that thing that you're just really into, no more maybe than you should about. What would you say you're most nerdy about?
God, I think it would have to be, you know, the cosmos, and Carl Sagan's like my hero. You know, we are a way for the cosmos to know itself. It's like, you know, I the whole concept of are we living in a simulation? Like, what is real? You know, what and Scared to Death dips into that a little about what you see, and you know, that fascinates the science of that observation, consciousness, that shit. I'm a full on nerd about that. And talk to my friends, they're just like, oh yeah. I'm like, we're in a ball of rock flying freaking through space at 100,000 miles. Oh yeah, okay. How was your lunch? You know what I mean? I obsess on that. That's why, you know, I Heart Huckabees is one of my favorite movies. Mark Wahlberg in that film where he's having the existential crisis about life. You know, I'm writing a film called Micro Macro that's all about that. It's about someone just coming to terms with what it really is and just pissing everybody off, you know. That's kind of important, because that's kind of what I do. I mean, I don't piss people off, but I just get, I'm so fascinated by it. I can't put it down and just be like, oh yeah, life is what it is. You know what I mean? I'm just, and that's why I think big things are coming up in the next year. With Disclosure, I mean, maybe it's all going to be a big, you know, con, but I'm telling you, in the next couple of years, I think there's going to be some big revelations.
I'm
really excited about that.
Okay, number two, what's something that you love to eat?
I would say, I mean, you know, I grew up in Scotland, so I love sweets and candy, but I can't eat them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So a nice piece of filet mignon with some eggs. That's it. That's all I need. It's a protein.
A fried egg? Poached. Or poached? Oh, okay.
Yeah. Huh. Salt and pepper.
I did not know you put poached eggs on a... Wait, as a side or on top of it?
No, I'll have it as a side, but I'll
leave it side.
I'll put it on top of the toast.
Okay. And
then I'll take a slice of the steak with the egg in the top.
Okay. Hmm. That sounds protein, pretty good.
Protein. And I love Thai food. Oh my God. I live in Thai Town in Hollywood, and it's just, I'm in heaven. You know, there's like 50 restaurants every, just get the best Thai food for $10.
Right. What is something that you love to drink?
Something like coffee.
Coffee. Okay.
Like David Lynch, 20 cups a day.
Yeah. No, I'm in Seattle, so that's everyone around
me. It's kind of a problem. You know what I mean? But I make it at home. I mean, I say that as a problem, as I guess in other people's eyes. But for me, I'm just, you know, I don't really drink a lot of booze.
Yeah.
You know, I don't smoke ciggies. I smoke a lot of ganja. The ganja and the coffee, they just cancel each other out.
Well, what kind of music do you love?
Well, my number one is Prince. You know what I mean? Period. Bottom mm-hmm. line. But, you know, I grew up as a teddy boy. It was Elvis and 50s rock and roll and doo-wop. And then, of course, Bowie, you know.
Okay. Like,
glam rock. But Prince is my number one. I saw him a bunch of times in the 80s and have never seen anything like that before. And, you know, I've worked with some of the greatest musicians in the world. You know, biggest. And but, yeah, him. You know, Freddie Mercury. I cried when Freddie Mercury died too, man. You know, there's just... And the way Prince died, you know, with the fentanyl and the pills and all that.
Yeah.
Get the surgery. Just tragic.
Diamonds and Pearls will always be a
Good, I love
have,
that.
Have a special. It was a special time in my life when that came out.
I believe that. That's a good one.
What do you love to create?
Well, apart from stories, you know, because I believe storytelling is a kind of lost art, and I mean sitting around telling stories too, is I'm a collagist. I make a lot of collage art, you know, cut and paste, glue, sellotape, sketchbook. You know, yeah, that's my passion.
Collages.
Mm-hmm.
Love it. My daughter just started working on those. She just started, like, she's 8. No, yes. No, she's 10. She's 10. Wow. I should know this. But she just started working on collages on her wall. She got
that's
a kit
awesome.
On it.
Encourage yeah. that. It's great because, you know, you get to rip through magazines and newspapers, you know, stuff that doesn't, and everything's on the web now. You know, I go to old bookstores and pull stuff up, you know, a buck for an old medical reference book, chop that up. It's great fun, and it's tactile. You know, kids now are doing everything on their iPads and their phones, but doing it literally, we have a physical object. You know, you know, I have sketchbooks going back for years, and treated music videos the same way, kind of, to learn film, was just try that, try this, try that. And that's kind of the same with my movies. They're all very different. I don't want to get into a groove of just telling one kind of thing. I want to experiment. That's a big part of that. You know, my film course was in London at St. Martin's, was fine art film. It wasn't USC. It was, they gave us a clear roll of celluloid and said, go make a film. And I'm like, there's no emotion on it.
Yeah.
They're like, man, figure it out. We were like crushing berries and, you know, drawing on the film and then taking that and putting it through a projector and going, oh, okay. You know, and learning all about constructivist film. It was weird because I was already doing it when I was little, but getting that education and beginning to understand the power of image and symbolism and you know, the meaning, it just changed everything for me and made me realize I want to do my own films. But that took a long time. You know, it was a big famous producer once told me, he goes, oh, you can do it your way. You can write and direct your own movies. He goes, it's just going to take a lot longer. You know, because movies in Hollywood are put together by producers. They pick the director, pick the actor. You know, it's not writer, director, actor. You know, and that's why for me, if I end up staying indie my whole life and making, I'm perfectly happy with that. As long as I can retain the IP and retain control of the overall, you know, it doesn't matter if we stay, you know, small and indie.
Okay. Two more questions. What's a game you love to play?
Chess.
Oh, God. I've been Duolingoing chess for the last... I'm on 87 days straight now.
Wow.
I find my brother's so good at it. He's an A&R with United Artists, and his passion is chess. And he's so good. And so it's like, I gotta catch up to him a little bit.
My
so
first film, Vicious Circle, is about chess. It's chess, and there's a sketchbook in the film. The sketchbook comes to life. It's all chess. Every character represents a different chess piece. It's called Vicious Circle.
Okay.
It's a Hispanic Latino drama. We made it in 2006, and we're hopefully going to be re-releasing that. It got signed to Maya.
Check that out.
It got a deal with Maya releasing, and then they closed like 6 months later. But
okay.
Yeah.
Last question before I get kicked out of here.
Yep.
In 100 years, when someone reads your biography, what do you want to be remembered for?
Oh my God. Well, it's not going to be directing the music videos for Shania Twain.
Okay.
Which is what everyone goes, oh, you did the videos for Shania Twain. No, hopefully we just remember for telling good stories. That's it, man. You know, if I can make, you know, this is film 5. If I can just make, you know, different films, a collection of films that just somehow communicate the human spirit, you know what I mean? That's what it's about, really. You know what I mean? It's, you know, we'll see. I mean, who knows? You know what I mean? And I can't live for that. You know what I mean? I mean, look at Van Gogh. You know, he made the most incredible art and died. No one knew. I mean, died a pauper. You know, so for me, it's a really beautiful observation you just made, because that's the truth about the RR, is that it could be still here in 100 years. Mm-hmm. People could be watching scared to death. Yeah. Think about the library of films by then. I have 8 million horror movies. Which one do I pick? The robot turns around and says, what? Scared to death?
Yeah.
Yeah, the future is, I think we're alive at a great time, man, with technology and everything and AI. It's going to really change the shape of our industry, and I'm all for it, man. I'm excited to see what happens.
Good. Hey, I could talk to you for an hour, but I guess I don't have that much time. So thank you, Paul, for coming on your new film, Scared to Death. It's hitting. Are we opening live nationwide?
Yeah, AMC. Right. Yeah.
AMC. Okay.
I think we're in 150 screens nationwide, and in Los Angeles, we're at AMC Burbank, which is great. It's the biggest horror theater in the States. So yeah, hopefully all the ducks will line up and people will go see it.
Oh, I hope so too. All right. Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks, Silas. Appreciate it, man.
Okay. And that was Paul Boyd, Scottish filmmaker. Samantha, I don't know. This is totally, you know, you have little, I at least have little prejudices that don't show up until unexpected moments. I cannot tell you how surprised I was to discover his all-time favorite artist was Prince.
Really?
I just don't think of it as a Scottish guy.
And like, a bagpipe artist?
Maybe. I don't know. I don't know. And that's the thing is like, well, what did I expect him to be into? I don't know. I guess, I don't know. But if for some reason, like, I'm hearing a Scottish accent and I don't think like, oh, this guy clearly loves the soul man of soul. Like, right? Like, I don't know. That was like,
that's funny.
And then I hear it and I'm like, well, of course he did because Prince was amazing. Like, why am I so prejudiced like that? Why would I think that? I don't know.
Probably based off of personal history, right? I mean, our minds associate certain things for a reason. Pattern recognition is not always correct.
Yeah.
But for me, that's his Scottish accent. I was just like, yes, please just talk for forever. It's such a wonderful accent. Oh my goodness.
I just heard something today about how we are, as humans, one of our special abilities is pattern recognition. And like even more than say a computer should be able to recognize it. But like we recognize patterns in ways that we don't realize.
Mm-hmm.
Like consciously. Like we subconsciously pick up on patterns and mm-hmm. previous behaviors. I've heard some similar things like that.
Yeah.
But I think that's true. I think because a lot of the people I know who are not Scottish, but very proud of their Scottish heritage.
Yeah.
They are not. The music they choose to listen to is not what I would consider the hippest music.
And I don't know very many people who are Scottish. Clearly, because I'm not just there openly. Listening to them right now. That's openly.
They're in the closet about it, or they don't identify as Scottish. I was trying to go with a pronoun joke, but
that will get you canceled. So
it will.
So I know, and you wouldn't even mean it anyway. You'd be like innocently canceled for being a huge ally, made a bad joke. Silas, you're comic to be. Yeah,
that happens. The movie's called Scared to Death.
Mm-hmm.
That he's in, so like a horror comedy. You're not a big horror fan, right?
What gave that away? Oh my gosh.
But how do you feel about the horror comedy? Is that a separate thing, or is it because it's going to involve blood that it's going to be like out?
Ugh. I mean,
funny squirting of stuff blood.
I mean, I can watch some vampire movies, depending on how much blood is involved, I guess. I mean, I have seen Game of Thrones, so I suppose if the plot is good enough, I can watch it. But if it's gory, just to be gory, I'm not, I don't know. But hearing about it and, you know, that it is a horror comedy and the thought process behind it and the filmmaking process and this and that, I actually am quite interested,
mm-hmm.
Where normally I wouldn't be. I have actually acted in two horror shorts.
Yeah.
But I wasn't in the very scary parts, so.
Right. Which are they I don't even know if in film it's actually scary. because with every, when you're shooting it, right, it's like the cameras are there and you're like, you're trying to figure out the practicality of it all. It's like,
I don't know. I don't want anybody to like not hire me based off of what I'm about to say, but you know what? You would get a very, very real looking actor. I still remember in high school, my theater teacher, he was showing us stage makeup. And for Halloween, he was showing how, I don't know if this is how they still do it, but back then, this is how they did stage makeup. If somebody was like cutting a wrist or something, like I can't even talk about, they, you know, he put down some like metal thing under it or whatever, you know, and then put the putty in the blood or whatever. And he was showing how, and I just was like, oh, and they're like, Samantha, you just saw what, I'm like, what is, oh man.
You fall, you're, you get into it, right? Like you get into that.
Just hearing about it or thinking about it. Like, here's the thing. I can have ketchup, no problem. But if I'm pretending that ketchup is blood for something, it's probably not going to be a good situation.
Right.
Yeah. Unless if I was the character, like if I was Lady M or something where it was like.
Oh, blood. Yeah, you did. You did Lady
M. Yeah, I mean.
Wasn't your hand bloody in that? Did you not?
You were imagining. I didn't actually have. I don't think I ever had actual bloody hands.
But isn't there a scene where she goes off and then comes back and her hands are all bloody, right?
I can't remember how we did it now. It was such a long time ago that I don't remember if we actually put any makeup on, like any stuff on there, or if it was just like imagining. See, I don't remember the play well enough to tell you that part.
You blocked out all horror elements of it.
Yes, I sure did.
I end up dealing with horror way more than I ever thought I would. And it just blows my mind how practical it all is. Like in doing it, I think that does show me how some of the magic is of film.
Yeah.
Is like, we made it look scary-ish or maybe scary. And just to think of how stupid it was when we were doing it, or just like there's one where I'm supposed to I was supposed to bleed out of my mouth, right? And so we had to get it in and hold it while we're like, okay, roll. And I'm, you just get to the point like, geez, can we just go? Because I'm like, I can't talk or do anything until this scene. And you also know, you know, at our minimal budget levels, we have one shot at this.
Because
I only have the one shirt. So if this gets bloody, we're done.
It's the Alexander Hamilton of screenshots. You're not gonna miss your
not
shot.
Not taking away.
I need to stop giving references that aren't totally fresh in my head. Yeah.
Not throwing away my one shot.
Exactly. With your one shirt and your blood packet, your pretend blood packet in your mouth.
Yeah. Because, I mean, for those of you that don't do film, usually they will try to buy multiples of outfits, even if you're not doing horror. If you're doing anything that might involve like physical work of getting it dirty, they will try to have like two of the exact same shirt if it's within financial means, right? Like The Office, I've heard them talk about they get a prop and they have like six of them because they need to make sure that they're like, because they can't afford for it.
Why doesn't use his nunchucks on them or something? Like
right. If something breaks or whatever, they need to have it there to go right away. So they always have multiples of whatever prop it is they make a bunch of. So.
Oh, wow. I think the other thing too with that is also like, I know he's talking about superstition, or you were asking, do you believe if things are haunted? Part of it is just, my sort of lack of desire to like delve into that realm at all. Like I will seriously be like, depending on what you talk about, get me some holy water. I will just start spraying. I just don't mess around with some of that stuff, which is a little bit funny considering some of the plays that I've been in, but I think, it's a little bit different when I'm doing the play or something. I don't know.
But I can see that. That makes sense to me. Like though this is my bias, I guess, of being of a performer is how I can separate the art of it from my tangible life. So like, I don't know. It's like how I watch professional wrestling. I'm fine with it. But a UFC fight where it's real, I'm like, no. Well, no, I can't. I can't handle it. No, turn it off. I like it to be theatrical.
Right.
It has to be in the world. Yeah, and we're there. But not like...
It's still weird that I went to a UFC fight and I actually was shouting.
Weird.
I know. That was many, many years ago.
You did what? You fought?
I was actually shouting for the person that I wanted to win. I got really, really into it. I was really hyped up on too many red vines. And clearly it was not my idea to go. It was my, you know, the person I was seeing at the time.
Well, what did you yell? Like, get him.
Well,
go.
I was chanting the person's name because they had gotten me into the stories like behind you. That was my gateway into caring, was like, listen to this person's life story and look at how they train and their mindset and this and that. And I was like, oh, wow.
So you're chanting like Rocky.
Well, it was Sledgehammer. Okay. That was the person. And I was chanting Sledgehammer.
You were shouting Sledgehammer.
That was the fighter's like name or like his.
What was the rhythm cadence? Was it Sledgehammer? Sledge.
This was a long time ago. Okay. It's pretty foggy. All I know.
I just feel like if I yelled the word Sledgehammer, I would remember what. It's such a weird thing to be yelling.
One would think. I vaguely remember.
Sledgehammer.
Was not like that.
Sledgehammer.
But you know, the thing that kind of sucked is I don't think he landed the punch I was hoping he would. And then later I was thinking about it and I'm like, oh, it's a good thing he didn't. Because if he did, that guy would have been like seriously injured.
You wanted him to drop the hammer?
I guess. You know what? If I'm not remembering this correctly, anybody who's listening, clearly I've probably edited this in my. Do you ever wonder about that?
You got bloodlust.
I just wanted that. I really wanted that person to win. And I didn't care for the other fighter, bless his heart.
Like, did you know their story, though? Did you know the other fighter story?
Yeah, yeah. That's part of why I was voting for the other one so much. I just really wanted them to have a win. This is based on the knowledge I knew at the time, you guys. So if you're listening, and if I was wildly off and come out on either of them,
you find out that Sledgehammer is this awful.
That might be out there. Just know that was not any knowledge that I.
We're going to have to research Sledgehammer now and find out what he has done. That's hilarious.
Silas. Okay, this is make me get more on topic if necessary, because you know I'm not talking about the interview enough. But during the 100 or the world famous 100 questions. Oh my gosh, yeah, we'll do 100 questions during the world famous questions. Chess. How did I not know that you love to play chess?
I don't know.
I'm not good at it now, but I used to be. But I mean, that was just comparison to like, you know, when you're playing as a kid, and not many other people play. I should learn the rules. And then
you don't know the rules.
I just know the basic rules, you know, like pawn this, that goes that way. I don't know like plays and everything.
I will say, you know, it's what inspired me to start playing. My brother plays. And so that, you know, that got me like for a week. Playing online like chess.com or whatever site he was using, right? I forget if I played him once. Anyways, he's really good. He plays all the time, or he used to at least. And I had shown my daughter Sierra how to play before, and you know, she feigned some interest in it, but we never really played much. I always felt like occasionally I would find someone who played and we're like, oh hey, let's play, and maybe we would there's a chess club at my kid's elementary school now, run by a black man, and I love
it. You're
the one who runs it. The one who runs it is a black man.
I'm teasing. Yeah. I was like, you're the one. That's an interesting way of telling me that you now run a chess club at your kid's school.
No, and I was just like, I just feel like it's one of those things growing up. I never knew black people that liked sci-fi or played games like chess. Like, I just never knew that. So, like, it's not in my pattern recognition. So, I've been excited. I've been trying to get my kids to want to go and play it with him. And because, you know, also, there's like four black parents at Cyree, right? And he's one of them. So, it's like that's an instant bonding, right, for one thing. And So they've been playing. So I hear the kids talking about it a bunch at there. And then I discovered that, like 3 months ago, I discovered Duolingo also now has a chess option.
I heard you say that. And I'm like, what?
Yeah. Like, you can, and I use that for Spanish, huh?
How much is Duolingo?
Well, there's a free version and then there's a paid version. So you could do the free version and just, it runs ads sometimes, right? So
I could play chess on Duolingo.
Yeah, you can only, or you need to, like, you have to build up so much energy to get to play more, mm-hmm. or like, you know, it refills over the night, mm-hmm. or if you're like correct and you win something, you get more energy so you can play longer. Like, that's for all the languages, and also teaches math, I think, as well. And anyway, I was like, oh, let me try this out. And I forgot that I bought the actual pass. So for Spanish, like 7 months ago or something, I was trying to learn some Spanish. So I was like, oh, so I can do all of these here.
Just kind of for fun, or do you?
Yeah. I always feel stupid that I took French in high school instead of Spanish.
I did too. Don't feel stupid.
You took French. Well, I mean, okay. But here's the thing. I was in Boston, near Boston. So I was like, well, I'm near French Canada. Yeah. And at the time I was like, well, French is it's a romantic language. Yeah. And I want to be a romantic guy.
Yeah.
And then I moved to California, where Spanish would have been really good to have known.
Well, yeah.
Would have helped me a lot.
There's some
so, and then I keep running into situations where Spanish would have been really good for me to know. French has been very few times. And so I've never practiced it. However, like Gretchen took French.
Yeah.
You took French. Like, I meet all these people who took French in my life. So somewhere there's the line, I was meant to do it. I don't know. So anyway, like, so I start playing, and now I hit 92 days today of continuous play. Like, I've played at least once a day.
Oh man, you're going to be really hard for me to beat then. Cause isn't it terrible that I was really happy to hear you play chess also, cause I thought it's going to be fun to win. I am just,
it doesn't mean I'm good.
Yeah, I'm sure you are. It's, you know, it's just, I love to win at games so much, and I'm not usually in, here's the thing, with my friends, I'm so much nicer about it. With my family, I am like a savage. I'm like, I just, like, I won, in your face, ha, let's play again. Or like, if they win once, it's like, nope, you're not leaving on a win. I'm gonna, I probably just had to assert myself a lot as the youngest child. I think probably I got a lot of joy out of winning something. Yeah. Perhaps.
That's reasonable.
But.
Well, it's like there's a level I can't get past because it scores you. Like, it has a rating system, right? That you build up to. And I'll start getting into the, like, 800s, which I thought was really good until I looked up and found out that was, like, beginner.
Well, I'm so curious if I have time to go on that. I'm totally gonna check it out.
I'll get up there, and then I'm like, oh, I beat someone at like this higher level, and then I just start losing, and I can't, and then I'm back down into the seven, then lower and lower, and then I'm coming back up, like, because also there's people who know tricks. And they try to knock you out fast.
That's what I was wondering about, like, teaching the rules, like, you know, certain plays and things like that.
See, I don't know what the plays are to actually do, but I've had them happen against me. So now I know, like, if I see one opening move, I know what to do to stop that opening move. Like, I know they're going for the two move kill.
Yeah.
Like, they know that. And I'm like, okay, I'm just, let me. So I know how to stop those. So it's all about learning what those. But then there's other ways to do it and figuring out
that's got to be really good for your brain. I don't know. I haven't looked up what the studies are, but I would.
But learning new things. Learning things is just always good for you. So it's very good brain
health. Depending on what the thing is.
But then I showed Finn wanted to play real chess. And so we played, and look, I didn't go hardcore on him, but I was told to not let him win.
Yeah.
I was told I should play him. The chess teacher.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So you don't just lie. They got to learn.
Gosh, that's...
I beat him, and he cries.
Oh, but see, that's hard. I don't know. Like, I didn't like, let my nieces win, because I wouldn't play as hard on them, right? But I wouldn't, like, just let them win. But my kid, I'm like, ooh, I don't know.
That I know a couple of these tricks, I'm like, oh, I could probably just do this and he won't know. Mm-hmm. And I'll just beat him real fast. So I let it go and I didn't take some opportunities. I'm like, oh, well, let me just go over here. I want to try to win this.
Yeah, well, because I felt like it was, you know, I wasn't doing the competitive savage thing. Then I was doing it to help them, because it's like, this is how they're going to learn. If I just go easy and let them win all the time, I'm not helping them, right?
Yeah.
But I wouldn't play like really, really as intensely as with like adults. But with my kid, I'm like, that'll be an interesting thing to...
But also, I don't know how it goes from playing on a screen to a real chess set, because I think there's a difference, like on what you can see.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's easier to see it on a screen.
That makes sense, yeah.
Though I think I take more time in person. I'm probably going to examine a bit more. Like when I have been like, wait a second, okay, hold on, because I think I know I don't see everything yet.
Yeah.
So I'll see.
We should do, among our many, many events that we're going to be clearly be doing,
a chess tournament.
At a Black and a Half sponsored chess
tournament, yeah.
Or there's something funny in there and just fun.
But what I like about what Duolingo does is it's a bunch of, it teaches you how to do things in like chess lessons.
Mm-hmm.
Like puzzles, basically. Like, here's a puzzle. How to get, like, it teaches you what a thing is and how to do that in situations. And I think it's just kind of teaching you sort of to notice when a situation arises.
Yeah.
And now I have noticed a couple times that I was like, oh, wait, if they don't move that, then I'm going to have this thing happen.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm prepared now, because you do learn. It does teach you. It's not just playing alone. Playing is probably the best way. But it's like skill study,
mm-hmm.
like working on the specific skill a little bit. And then putting into practice in practice games is important.
And then you can like go to some of these meetups too. Well, I don't know how often they're going on, but when I was looking for a meetup a couple of weeks ago, I saw there was one that was like a chess meetup. And I was like,
I'd be so intimidated there. I'm like, you're all going to be smarter than me.
Nah.
You're going to get my butt kicked in 3 seconds. And then I go, oh, I'm really bad at chess, but I'm good at selling houses. Hey. I only lost to you so that you would use me. I'm going to whoop you. Play for a house. Well, that's what you do. You get really good, and then you like act low. Like, okay, well, let's put a wager on this. How about you let me list your house?
Right.
I beat you, and then you're like, boom, 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 boom. Oh, did I beat you? Sorry.
Oh, did little old me do that?
Oh, no. Yeah, I just love. I love games. I'm such a big, like any game. I just love playing.
See. It's so nice to, like, yeah, games are good times.
And it's so, like, I hate it when, it's been the hardest part in my relationships have been, I just generally have relationships with people that don't want to play long games.
Like, what kind of game is a long game? And actually, one other thing real quick before I don't know. Sometimes though, I don't have patience for listening to the rules of the game. And I think it's probably the way that I learn. Like when people are just, you know, you're reading off the whole thing. It's like, it's more helpful if I see them say, this is how you do this. This is how you do yeah. that. But like listening to the whole thing. It's sometimes like,
I can see that.
Yeah.
I mean, well, I like a risk type game, you know.
Never played that.
A 2 to 3 hour game, that's good. But also, I could do a board game every night if, like, I could do that if I had a gaming partner, or at least every weekend, I'd love to do game nights. My kids, it's hard because I want them. I just know they're not developmentally there yet to play some games, and I hate Candyland. Like, oh my god, some of these games are so.
Should the diabetes bring me coma rage. Game?
Huh?
The diabetes coma game.
Yeah.
Right? Isn't that? It's just like a candy.
Yeah, it's just candy.
You could do improv games with them. It's not the same as a board game. I know it's not the same as a board game.
And then some seem complicated, and then it's the sensitivity about losing. And I'm like, I lost all the time. I don't get why they are so sensitive about losing things. I'm not even trying.
Well,
but then they're happy when they win accidentally. You know, that's what they like about Candyland and stuff.
Yeah, well,
because anybody can win.
Everybody wants to have a win.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm so bad at Cards Against Humanity. I do like a lot of different types of game, but I often like word games though, I think, or solving some sort of clues. I do enjoy Clue as well, but even Clue sometimes creeps me out. It's so ridiculous. Just imagining, like, especially if you're playing late at night and it's like, oh, they had the candlestick. Oh no, which one's the killer? Like, how? It's so ridiculous. It's so ridiculous.
What was it? I just heard somebody talk about that, how they think there should be an age limit on. They think there should be an age limit on the presidency because they were playing Risk against their dad or their grandfather, and how. One of them just suddenly decided to attack Asia with all their troops. And he's like, what are you doing? He's like, it's late. I want to go to bed. And you're like, oh, yeah. Sometimes they just want to be over with this.
I could kind of see that, though. But I don't know. I've never played Risk. Who knows? I'm kind of curious now.
That's good. I'm going to invite you to this.
Is it a Risk game?
No. I'm going to invite you to...
Duolingo chess.
I'm seeing if it's possible.
Oh, well, that's so cool.
I'm discovering all these people that are.
That's so.
It's funny, like, who?
Who
shows up on my.
I don't know if I would have gone to the chess meetup that I saw, though. It was like. Probably like just all guys 10 years older than me or something. And I'm just thinking, I don't think I'm going to show up to this.
Kate, this is what I find this fascinating. Right now, there's somebody, I hit contacts, right? And it shows your contacts where they're from. In my phone is a girl named Katie. And it says Puyallup Swing Dancer.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, so that's some girl in Puyallup that I met at the same time I met Gretchen. Swing dancing. And I'm like, who? I don't remember who this is.
You're lucky you're a real estate agent. Otherwise, you would need to delete that immediately. In fact, go ahead and delete that immediately. I'm kidding. I know.
But I'm like, I don't even... The thing is, if I type in Katie Swing Dancer, they don't show up in my contacts, so I don't understand.
Mm.
Oh, unless I'm like... I'll say the thing I think about sometimes when I was back when I was single, like how many things could have gone, the sliding door moments, right? Of, oh, well, if I had decided to try over here or try over there, like what could have happened?
Death.
Sometimes it's just in that I might have never met Gretchen if I had done the wrong thing. Right?
Well, but in sliding doors, they do meet each other either way.
Oh, that's true. Isn't that like a point of it or something? But they went through a rough life in one way. Like it all
in one
rough.
Way it did. And I think that was the way in which sometimes it's better. I think that was the version where it's like sometimes better to wait and go through something tough than to like have more instant gratification and then it ends tragically. I Actually, I ought to rewatch the movie. It's been a long time. Also, Scottish accent in that movie, right? That her love interest in it.
Oh, is that a Scottish guy?
Wait, I think so.
The new love interest, not the one that breaks.
Oh no, the good one, not the jerk.
The jerk face.
Yeah, not
the jerk face monster.
Not the jack face monster. That was not that accent. I wasn't trying, though. Don't worry. I was not trying.
I got to post this video. It just, part of me is like a little stupid. It's stupid, but right. Willow wanted me to do a commercial.
Yeah.
And so I was like, I was just talking to the camera. She's like, dude, dad, do the commercial. And then I'm like, and then at one point she said, use your normal voice. And I just started doing a bad, like, hello, my name is Silas, and it's Diane. I'm a real estate agent, buy a house. And she's like, no, no, no. And it's really funny to me, but I don't know if other people find it
to hear as her funny. In the background. Like, you well, hear her.
I keep turning it back to her. Like, what? Was that right? Was that right?
Da-da-da. Oh, I think that's funny.
So, yeah, I might post it, but I was like, you know, sometimes I don't want to be the. I always worry about being the super obvious guy trying to get attention. But then I'm also a super obvious guy who wants attention. So
yeah, I was like, I feel like that ship has sailed. I think everybody who knows you is, as you told me, Samantha, people love you even because of your imperfections. Like, I think.
But I'm like, I don't want to be sales. I was like, it's like, I don't want to be salesy, but this is really funny.
It is funny, but also some of the stuff is salesy. Like, you know, like you put up your flyer, like your postcards, they're salesy, but they're funny. You know, yeah. it can be an and sort of situation. It doesn't have to be a just one thing.
And that's a good point.
Yeah. And I think that's a delightful look into your life. And your daughter is adorable. For me, I just am very careful about sharing anything about my kid's face on the internet.
Yeah.
Because of.
Yeah. Things.
Crazy world we live in. But you know, but sometimes, yeah, obviously I can't resist myself and a picture goes up.
I will say, I don't know. You saw my Oreo thing that I did?
Yeah. Oh, but also, like, typically women tend to be more careful than the dads are with that sort of stuff. Yeah.
But you saw the Oreo
thing. That's what I'm saying. The Oreo. Yeah. On your face. Yeah. Yeah.
So
it was funny.
I mean, that was clear. Okay. So I had this moment of like, I was like, well, that, I was like, that's kind of fun. I kind of want an Oreo. I was actually hungry. So I was like, I want the Oreo.
Where's your cup of milk?
Because we hadn't eaten. I didn't get to eat, and I'm like, I'm kind of hungry. And then, like, what got me to go decide to try it was like, oh, this would be good content, wouldn't it? Okay, let me go. And I was like, record me. Okay.
Oh, you asked them to record you?
Because well, my friend was there. I was wondering. So I asked him. I said, record me. And said,
oh, good.
And so I went to do it, and then I'm like, okay.
And I was waiting too. I was like, is it gonna work?
I did it a second time and I failed again.
Like, sucked into being like, is it going to work?
I tried it twice and it didn't work. But the next person after me started using my eyebrow technique. Like, apparently I was the first one in the time to come up with that idea of just being subtle. I was like, okay, I think I got this. I don't know. I thought I was gonna get it too. And then it got stuck on my eye and I didn't know. I was like, I'm trapped. In case you haven't seen, you go to any of my socials. And you'll find me trying to eat. The challenge is you put an Oreo on, you sit down in a chair, you put an Oreo on your forehead and need to get it into your mouth without touching your hands. And that's the challenge. And somebody, Jose Bolaños from the morning show, he said he'd done it before or he's done the challenge before. And it's so hard. And I was like, I had never heard of this before. I thought I was like, what? This is crazy.
So funny. Oh, my gosh.
It was really fun, but I did, it did push me over to go, this would be good content.
Oh, definitely.
So let me go do this.
Excuse me.
Or potential. Yeah. But then I realized how my belly stuck out while I was doing it. And so then I started eating better the next day. So it reminded me of, what got me to lose the big amount of weight a few years ago was a picture my friend Joseph Greenauer took of me at playing poker, and he like put that up, or I saw it and I was like, holy crap, that's me. And it got me to change my whole thing. I was like, I'm done. Next day I started.
Oh man.
I always have to have one thing that pushes me over the edge. Ugh, and that video might've done it for
me. It's just, It can be very humbling to see oneself and then see, like, that's not how I imagine myself.
Well, it's always just funny to see so many, you see so many pictures and you see yourself in things all the time. And then for some reason, one angle just goes, oh no. You know, because you're usually trying to make yourself look good in some way. Feel like dancing.
Dancing. Okay, I know that we're pretty much at time, but one thing I really wanted to say, or I took some notes listening to his interview.
Yeah.
I was just listening to the voice. But but I didn't realize that the national animal is a unicorn. I was like, that is really fun.
I put that in my newsletter last month. Yeah. I thought that was hilarious that he brought that up. I was like, what?
Yeah, that's so cool.
Maybe he's a reader. I don't know.
And then, that our eyes filter out most of what we can't see or something like that. That basically, like, there's so much going on in the world, on Earth, like the cosmos, whatever. There's so many things that we cannot see, and that our eyes are so focused on what we can see, it's easy to forget what we can't see.
Right. Well, I got the idea that, like, because there's light, there's just colors that we cannot see that exist.
Yeah.
There's different light, infrared, there's different frames
there's so
that
much
you cannot
that we can't see.
Right.
And there's something that I heard in, I forget where I heard this. Probably some other, you know, podcast or, I don't know, book or whatever. But that so much of life actually happens in the invisible world. But almost all of our focus is on the visible one.
Hmm.
And I sat and marinated with that one for a while. And that comment that he had reminded me of that. You know, I think it's good to remember that every now and again. Actually, daily, I think it's good to remember that. I mean, you want to be you want to be based in reality. Like, there's obviously reality, but there's a lot of stuff that, like, we can't see.
Yeah. Well, and I've wondered that about ghosts and such, is that, like, they're just in a plane that we can't see.
Oh, gosh. I guess I wasn't thinking about ghosts. I suppose I was more thinking about, like, energy and, like, spirituality and stuff
same
like
thing.
That.
Same thing.
I
energy.
Yeah, I guess. But, you know, getting me to talk about a ghost is a tricky subject. Yeah.
Well, and also, like I was trying to explain to my, I forget what I was explaining to the, I was explaining to the older daughter, because she can get it a little bit more, how we actually see everything upside down. Like, the way our eyes work, we actually see everything upside down.
Once before.
But then our body, it's not that we're upside down. It's just that the way we see everything
Eleven,
is upside down.
Is that you?
But that your brain flips it to make it make sense. Your brain actually flips the image you see to make it make sense. Have you heard that before?
I mean, not the brain flips it to make it make sense. I just figured it was like the way that, you know, that the light waves or whatever go so that it makes it that way. But
no, like, the way it inputs into your brain is upside down.
Upside down, that doesn't.
Because it's the same thing as when you take a picture. When you take a picture with the camera, the picture that's made, it inverts. And then it has to be re-put. It has to go back into its original way.
I mean, I won't argue with any science behind it.
So.
But if I'm right here and my bottle is right here and I could feel the top of my bottle.
Yeah, it's the top.
Yeah.
That's it's not
but
that
then,
it's upside
but then
down.
We both would be upside down.
We're not actually upside down. It's just that what we actually see is upside down, but our brain corrects it. Our brain constantly fills in information that we don't have, that we didn't see.
Yeah.
And the, one of the pieces, it fixes things that we can't. Do you know, like.
You know what? So that's a horror movie too, right there, maybe. It's like, right? if one person, their brain stopped doing that.
Oh, well, no, that happens. That's why we know. That's one of the reasons we know. Like, what? It actually happens to people.
Was that in Inception?
It's a brain injury. Something? What, how, huh?
Oh, I said, was that an Inception?
But when you get a brain injury, that's one of the things that can happen. It disconnects it, so it doesn't, you don't get it. If you, like, there's people that you get a tumor, right, in your head somewhere, in your, like, that you can't see, like, a spot where there's damage that you get on your eye, that there, you have a blank spot in the middle of your vision. After so many years, it disappears. It doesn't actually disappear, but your brain starts compensating for it and starts filling it in with the missing info.
Yeah.
That's why you're sometimes wrong about what the shirt, what shirt was somebody wearing? You don't remember. You're just looking and your brain filled in what color it should be. It's crazy. Our brain is so powerful.
Yes, it is.
Anyhow. Yes, you're right. We're about out of time here. So
yeah. Very powerful.
What a thoughtful, what a, it's great to nice. It's so great and nice to have an interview. You know, as I said, Paul, with Paul Boyd, thanks for coming on the show, Paul. We're available anytime you need actors.
Yes. If yes, yes. Oh, and we're comedians, so we can.
Yeah. Punch, script punch ups, whatever.
Help. Help to do that. Westerns, yes, absolutely.
Hire us, please. Anyway, hey, thank you very much for tuning in. Black and a half.
Black and a half.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to the longest running comedy podcast in Seattle, probably. Yes, this is Black and a Half, hosted by Silas Lindenstein and Samantha Rund. Black and a Half.